of communities. All right, so we can lead to, it can lead to a stereotyping of populations. All right, so for example, women in patriarchal societies. We could have done an ethnography in India, of which there have been many, that look at women's autonomy, women's ability to move about with freedom, women who live in female-headed households versus male-headed households, the role of the mother-in-law, number of different things. If I went to the library to study women in Botswana, I was doing an intervention for women in Botswana, and I know that Botswana is in fact a patriarchal society, and I went to do research on what that means when I'm designing a protocol for an intervention for women in a patriarchal society, and I picked up a study from India, I would be wrong. All right? The manifestations, it's not that it's a better society, but it is definitely different. Women in Botswana never have to ask where they go. They make a lot of decisions about things that women in India never are permitted to. So they manifest themselves differently. And if we are trying to design an intervention, we need to avoid this temptation of saying all women in patriarchal societies are second-class citizens. We need to, in consensus-driven, communitarian cultures, need to avoid, this is a very common one, anyone from a communitarian cultures all need to make decisions collectively. No individuals make decisions. And if we go from culture to culture with those population-based stereotypes, we run the risk of designing interventions that get it all wrong. The other problem with rapid assessment procedures, it can encourage researchers to assume that members of a culture, all members of a single culture, are the same. All right? Think of it, I was trying to think of the easiest way to give an example of that, and the easiest is all Catholics are opposed to birth control. If you're Catholic, you won't use birth control. And we all know from our own personal acquaintances that there's huge variability among Catholics in terms of how they feel about this topic. If we assume that women don't make decisions, and we make sort of a global assignment that this is a culture where women don't tend to make decisions, it's true in India, happens to also be true in Botswana, I've got to tell you that some of the most decisive, take charge women that I have ever met are in Botswana. They may be a minority. But if we design an intervention saying anyone who comes into our clinic can't give consent because she's female and she's going to have to come in with a male, you may find that you have a problem in getting participation from whole segments of your community because that's not the way women make decisions. So it's very important not to make the assumption. And when you come in and rapidly look at a community, it's really easy to say, oh, I get it. Women always ask their husbands. And so you design a protocol that does just that. The first course I ever took in the bioethics program was an international research ethics course. And I wrote a paper on women and informed consent. So it's been a recurring theme in my academic world. And I came across a website for the University of Virginia medical system, and I got all excited because it was headed something like promoting cross-cultural understanding. So I thought, this is good. This is great. I mean, a hospital is actually worrying about these things. So you clicked on India, and up came four bullets. Indian women will never be examined without their husband present. Indian women cannot make decisions, what their husbands make them. Explain procedures to the male. They had one on Muslims. They had one on Hindus. They had one on, and it was this list. It was like a menu, the quick and dirty. And it would be like having a quick and dirty on Americans. It's the same problem. And you know that we're different. And you know that some of us, even from very traditional, look at members of your family, the same origins, the same cultural and social norms vary in individuals by the extent to which they themselves accept those as normative behavior. So rapid assessments often invites that because you don't have time to look for the variability.
Or even the variability in how we understand a concept, like how does someone express a decision?
Right.
You know, here we just say, well, we say what we want. You know, if you're talking about women and men, there may be culturally prescribed ways of, you know, sort of everyone who's playing the game or, you know, enacting the cultural ritual knows that the woman is expressing her decision, but the way she has to do it is
exactly
a certain
exactly.
way.
So. And another thing, one of first of my many Botswana stories. There was in Botswana, no one says no to you. No one will look at you in the face and say no. That's a very, very, there I've just done a stereotype. It's a very unusual thing for someone to say no. But they say no all the time. And one of the ways they do it is they say yes and do nothing. All right? So if that's what happens, the first couple times that happens, you make a lot of assumptions about what just happened. Pen protocols go before the Ministry of Health for approval. Ministry of Health says, ooh, this is a problem. You'll see, I have a case that was actually an actual protocol with names changed to protect the innocent, of course. And the Ministry of Health sat on it for 3 years. On day one, their answer was no, this is not happening here. But they could not look at people whom they knew, who they exchanged pleasantries with, and say, we're not going to approve this. It's very difficult. What is the American conclusion? They lack training. They don't know what they're doing. They're politics. They don't like us. Somebody else put in a competing protocol and they'd rather go with them. None of the actual realities of what was happening on the ground. It's a different way of expressing a negative. So there are lots of examples like that. And when you go in rapidly, you don't necessarily pick up that that's what is happening. Right? I had, from a social science perspective, in my violence study, I had two people out of 491 people say no, say that refuse to be involved. Is that because they were deeply committed to my research study? Probably not. Probably there were other factors. Somebody was talking to women about themselves. They went into their homes. They walk up to the gate and they go, Coco, Coco, and it means, can I come into your yard? And when they're in your yard, they're your guest. And you never say no to a guest. So, and yet, I'm sitting here as a bioethicist saying, oh, I had informed consent from everybody, you know. Well, how informed is that? So when we're designing protocols, we have to put these things into perspective and keep them in mind. The other thing that happens with a lot of rapid assessment procedures and a lot of sort of short, truncated use of qualitative methods is that we don't spend enough time observing. I had to laugh yesterday. I sit on an IRB at Penn, and we had a protocol from an anthropologist here who is Argentinian, and she is doing research in Argentina. She is bringing down an undergraduate to help her. And the first month of a 2.5 month gig for the undergraduate is something called participant observation. And because it was so deeply ingrained in the anthropologist's way of approaching a problem, she couldn't imagine, despite the fact that this young woman was fluent in Spanish, she couldn't imagine turning her loose in a community and having her go collect information. So in her mind, participant observation was turning this young woman loose for a month, go to the clinic, go to the health center, go to a youth sporting event, go to the market, and just watch and take notes and think about this. Her only comment to the IRB was, she's going to do participant observation, and it will help inform how she looks at her data. Well, the IRB went nuts. This is data, and how are you going to protect it, and what kind of permissions? It's a totally different mindset from going in and quickly getting data, observational data, and living and breathing what a culture is like. And one of the most interesting differences that I kind of didn't think that Lambert talked about enough is the major difference in many biomedical research protocols that do these rapid assessments. One of the big differences is they already know what they're trying to find out, right? So they want to know what will uptake be of a certain drug. How willing will a community be to enroll in a vaccine trial? How likely is it that women will bring their pregnant sisters to an antenatal clinic? They've got a very specific question, and they're looking for an answer only to that. The other risk, which I think is actually one of the greatest, is we run the risk of imposing, actually, is a better word for it, our own belief systems into the findings. We get a piece of information, and we feel really good about it. We've looked at a culture, we've tried to understand it, and when we interpret it, we use our Western lens to look at it. Women are a very good example of this. And women in Botswana, I may be talking about a slide that's ahead, but I'll do it anyway because I think it fits here. Women in Botswana are not huge uptakers of either microbicide trials or of condom use. The ABC campaign in Botswana has been an abysmal failure. Condom use is way down. Women don't negotiate. Now, what does a Western researcher conclude from that? All of which is, by the way, also true. Women are often not in a position to negotiate condom use. Women lack birth control. Women don't have control over their reproductive health, and they need birth control. And if we did these things, everything would be fine. A rapid assessment would tell any biomedical researcher worth their salt that these things were true, and off you'd go. A long-term participant observation, particularly of young people in Botswana, would tell you that in Botswana, women put a premium on fertility, not on marriage. All right? So the value that they take into many relationships and sexual encounters is on being fertile. Very few women today marry as a percentage of the population, but all of them have children. So if you're trying to introduce a prevention program for the spread of HIV, condom use may not be simply a matter. Just saying we need birth control and we need condoms will not necessarily solve your problem. You need to think about it in a different context. You need to grapple with the fact that the view, but I as a Western woman would have said, it's obvious what the problem is. Women can't negotiate sex. So I might design an entire intervention around helping women learn how to negotiate condom use and miss the point that women had to first understand women had to first think about the price of pursuing fertility and therefore engaging in high-risk sexual behaviors. You had to get them to think about that before you could talk about condom use. So you would miss that. So what I refer to this as a silo approach to culture. So often in biomedical research, we have taken anthropological methods, but we streamline them down in the medical domain to focus on one specific problem. And when we do that, we not only take the anthropologist out of it frequently, but we often take the problem out of the context which shapes them. All right? So the example of the past two decades, the best example internationally is really HIV/AIDS. All right? We approached it as a medical problem. We approached it as a medical problem that was driven by the same set of variables throughout Africa, throughout Southeast Asia, and we therefore began to design biomedical interventions that would respond to those conditions. And we, by approaching it as a medical problem, it took us a while to realize that there were other forces shaping the emergence, the prevalence, and the lifespan of that disease in different populations. And we were missing a lot of the more nuanced views of what forces within communities, within particular populations, within different sexes, and within different nations might in fact be driving that epidemic. And this can go really wrong, and it does happen all the time. If we are so narrow in our view of the role of culture in a biomedical research environment, or even in a clinical environment, in another culture, we may in fact be solving one problem and creating a new one. All right? When we came along and introduced concepts of confidentiality into the discussion of HIV/AIDS, we, Western physicians, created stigma. All right? We had all the right motivations and all the right reasons why we thought confidentiality was important, but as it has played out in many parts of particularly Southern Africa and particularly in Botswana, we now have created a new problem. Now we need to remove the stigma from HIV/AIDS in order to have the kind of community-wide treatment and prevention programs that we need to find to address the epidemic in Botswana. Botswana has the highest rate of HIV/AIDS. The only country in the world that is higher than Botswana is Swaziland. So it is an enormous problem. And we have actually made prevention and treatment. We've done, Western research has helped tremendously, but we have also created a new set of problems to deal with. Yeah.
So going into that situation, obviously seeking confidentiality has created the taboo of, well, you don't talk about this, and that must be, you know, or because it's a problem or something like that. What's the alternative, though? I mean, I think it's problematic to say we're going to go in and not emphasize confidentiality.
So let me I can give you an example. In Uganda and South Africa are perhaps the greater extremes, but I'm going to do Uganda and Botswana because I'm more familiar with it. In Botswana, the Americans came in very early on, and this was a very good thing. I don't mean to be dissing our involvement in Botswana, because we have made an incredible difference there, and it is an American solution that has resulted in free antiretroviral treatment for everyone in the country. For the last decade, going through 2016. And shaping the care is something that we have done. But we brought with us a rights-based approach to HIV/AIDS that grew out of our culture here, predominantly with the gay community's cry that we had to have attention, that we were, they were rights. We crafted HIV/AIDS as our own disease. Meanwhile, over in Botswana, by 1985, they have their first case. By 1994, their life expectancy has dropped from 64 to 32. We arrive and we name the disease, and we bring with it all of our own views about rights and confidentiality. So we identify it as a very bad thing. We talk about confidentiality, but the way it is heard is you don't talk about it because it's bad. Right? And so we created people that were stigmatized in their communities. And now we spend a great deal of time undoing that. Lots of billboards, lots of radio programs, living a full life with AIDS. And when you live in a population where, in my community up in northwest Botswana, more than half of the women between 15 and 55 are HIV positive. You can't stigmatize an entire population. It just isn't going to function. So now go to Uganda. Uganda has had for years a local disease which they called SLIM. It may not be HIV. It may be something else. But it was a wasting disease. All right? When HIV/AIDS was first diagnosed in Uganda, they had a very forward-thinking leader at the time. The name is gone. I'm sorry. It's a 5 o'clock thing. Actually, it might be a 58-year-old thing, but it's gone. And he took on HIV/AIDS as a local problem. So we didn't have a lot of the Westerners brought this, like the English brought smallpox and blankets to the Indians. It was already here. It's ours. It's a local problem. We need local solutions. And so although Uganda is now one of the great success stories, and there are a lot of biomedical reasons why that is true, but there is also a fair amount of literature that says, we talked about it. We talked about what it meant to be HIV positive. We talked about what we'd get. And the president launched a campaign called Zero Grazing, which I'm going to come back to. And ultimately, when you really look at Uganda and you read what went on there, what really seems, in my opinion, to have turned the tide was a very local concept being used to address a medical problem. And that was zero grazing, and we'll come back to that. Is confidentiality important? Yes. But confidentiality that is stigmatizing is not necessary, and it's a very fine line. And when people are dying everywhere you look, we probably don't make those, we don't listen, is part of what happens, I think, in a lot of biomedical care when we're overseas. We don't listen, because we've made some assumptions about illiterate, sick. You'll see when we talk about my violence study, that over half of the women that I interviewed meet the clinical criteria for depression. Now, an HIV-positive grandmother whose children are dead and she is raising their children, she has no job, she has no food, and she lives in a hovel, comes in and hangs her head in the clinic. Of course she's depressed. Who wouldn't be? I mean, how depressing is that? My study showed no connection between the presence of a chronic debilitating disease and whether or not a woman was depressed. What it showed was that if she was beaten up, she was depressed. If she wasn't beaten up by an intimate partner, there was no way to predict whether or not she'd be depressed. And it has something to do with coping. What it is, what breaks down a woman's ability to cope with a catastrophe? Not a biomedical answer. But if you're a busy clinician treating HIV-positive women and a woman comes in and is sobbing and listless and unresponsive, you kind of say, yeah, life is bad. Life is hard. No wonder. What do we do with all these people? You don't treat it. You treat it as a symptom of the disease rather than a symptom of some sociocultural phenomenon. And you miss, and we all miss, and I hasten to say I missed until I did this, you miss a possible point of intervention, which is you do something about the violence, and in my case you do something about alcohol consumption, and you might find that people have better coping skills. You haven't necessarily made their life better. You haven't made any life-altering changes in their disease. But their ability to cope with that disease may have shifted, and therefore their ability to adhere to treatment, to encourage prevention in their children, a whole lot of other things become possible. From the Lambert study, there was this great line: rapid assessments may produce findings which are quick, practical, and wrong. And I think that is sort of the take-home message from her article, and I would say it is the take-home message from my talk in general. And if you remember it, you pause when you see things, and you pause and say, is this really what I'm seeing? The other thing that happens in biomedical research is we have a tendency to take social phenomena and turn them into data, all right? So in my study, which is sort of a mega study, I have what I call on-off switches. Were you beaten up in the last year or not? Yes or no. Did you drink last night? Yes or no. Did you drink last night? Yes or no. And it all goes into spreadsheets, and I get really excited with what I found. Now, these are very, very complex social phenomena. What made you drink? Why did you drink? When did you drink? Were you both drinking when you were beaten up? You know, you miss all that subtlety. And rapid assessments often end up being sending researchers out, click, ask a bunch of questions, come back, tabulate, make a decision based on that. There are reasons for it, very understandable. But sometimes you miss some of the more subtle things that may guide you in how you both design your study and evaluate your findings. All right? Rapid assessments have traditionally been used. They first were heavily used by biomedical research in international settings when what they thought was going to happen didn't. All right? In Botswana in particular, there's been a major drive to reduce maternal mortality. And the big drive was on prevention of mother-to-child transmission. And they went from having one of the biggest rate, highest rates of mother-to-child transmission in the world to having a rate of 2%, which is lower than the rate in the United States. I mean, it is a success story from all time. Has maternal mortality gone down? No. Maternal mortality is gradually going like this. 10 years on, the biomedical community is now saying, we don't know enough about women's lives. There may be some social phenomenon at play here that is shaping maternal mortality. And so that if we are going to intervene to bring this number down, and I'm sure if you have talked at all about Millennium Development Goals or you ever read any kind of international story, sooner or later you hear about our goal of reducing maternal mortality by 2015. So it's a big thing right now. So people are turning their attention to this and saying, we better think about some social phenomena. So social scientists are going, you know, but it is a little late in the day. So a lot of this sort of qualitative look has often come after the fact. Why did this happen? And it does inform what you do next. And particularly in HIV/AIDS research, there is now a premium placed on doing some qualitative or anthropological research at the start. How effective it is has great variability, as I've discussed. So let's go back to why it's important, in case you haven't heard it enough. Humans are part of human disease. And humans, as we know, are unpredictable. They are social creatures. They respond to social norms in positive and negative ways. The other reason is that we have to maximize the benefits we extract from this very growing global health enterprise. I read an article today that said that 65% of FDA-regulated clinical trials by pharmaceutical companies will be, by 2012, outsourced to emerging countries. That's a huge investment, and it's also going to be, therefore, the site of a lot of our findings about human disease. So making sure that we get good data and that we know what that good data is telling us becomes critical. Global health spending in 2007, which was the most recent number I could put my hands on globally, was $5.6 billion in 1990. It's $21.8 billion by 2007. That's a fourfold increase in 17 years. So there's this vast investment in global health that really obligates us in many ways to make sure that we get it right, that we are really maximizing the benefit from the dollars, not just globally, but in the communities in which we are conducting research and delivering care.
What is global health spending? What is that?
Global health spending. So it's government, it's bilateral, multilateral, and so it's money from outside of nations being spent in nations on global health.
Including
both clinical,
research?
It's just clinical.
Oh, okay.
All right. I believe. All right. So then I wanted to put in here, and I'm sorry I did this, but I spend my summers in Maine, and in Maine, people are always talking about things happening in the dooryard. And I'm going, there what? The dooryard is when you open your front door, it's the yard in front of you. Now, they could have a 2-acre yard, but that is not the dooryard. The dooryard is when you open your door, it's right there. So my guy that mows my lawn said, you had a dozen deer in your dooryard. And I'm like, my what? Where? Is this bad? Is that okay? In my dooryard. We have global health in our dooryard. So you do not have to journey abroad. You do not have to go be part of a research team or a clinical team somewhere else in the world to experience cross-cultural variability or to experience people from the same culture that have a different view and a different value system. So understanding the role that being human and being shaped by cultural and social forces has a great deal to say about how we deliver care in Philadelphia. So it is really global health here. The global health course I teach at Jefferson that Nora came and upset everybody. She did a great job talking about the role of culture. Because these are MPH students who didn't really want to hear about the role of culture. They were all about biostatistics, and it was very interesting. They were very sad that I had service projects in the refugee clinic that I wasn't going to sit there and tell them we're all going to go to, you know, we're going to go about 10 blocks over and we're going to talk about social norms among the Burmese that may impact how they present in the clinical setting. And so the global health is right here. And so it becomes imperative that the biomedical community begin to really put a value on some of this qualitative and anthropological data. So one of my drop boxes today, just to put this in perspective, was a funding opportunity released by NIH this morning. And you all can read it, but I'll read it out loud to pass the time. The funding opportunity announcement encourages applications that advance generalizable knowledge about HIV prevention through transformative behavioral and social science research. An underlying assumption for this funding opportunity is that methods of and findings from social and behavioral studies can make essential contributions to research that utilize biomedical modalities. I could not have said it better myself. But it is a sign of changing attitudes towards the use of social science. This is a fundamental change in saying, if we're going to crack this HIV/AIDS epidemic, we need social and biobehavioral information to help us do it. And that's mana to my ears. So I wanted to talk about look at it from a variety of different perspectives. And one of them is in this domain of language and meaning. You may have read in the article or remember reading in the article that the gold standard of research in another country when you are getting consent or handing out information is this phenomenon of translation and back translation. All right? So that means I write my pamphlet, I write my ad in English. Everybody looks at it and approves it. And I give it to a native speaker in that language, and they translate it. And I take that and I go over here to a native English speaker who has not seen an English version, and I ask them to translate it back into English. So I take my original version and sort of like playing telephone, I guess. Remember that game where you told stories and you waited to see what happened? So you see what comes back. You put them side by side, and you identify where translations did not accurately, lost in translation. All right, that's what you're looking for. And so then you correct it. This is fine. This is a good starting point. But it makes a fundamental assumption that is not all right, which is that words have the same meanings in different cultures. All right? So, well, things we see very commonly in international research. You go into communities where there are no words in the local language. There is no word for placebo in Setswana and many other countries and many other languages. There is no word for randomized controlled clinical trial. It cannot be translated. So there's this sort of hodgepodgey thing that goes on to come up with those words. But as importantly, the reason there are no words is because the words have no meaning. And that's the piece we lose in this translation, back translation, that's adequate. We lose that concept. So the Inuit have 1,000 words for snow. There's a word for snow in Setswana, but that's because they read English Christmas carols. right? They know about Santa Claus, and they know what snow is. Do they actually know what snow is? Do they know snow is cold? Do they know it's made of crystals? They know no two crystals are totally, whereas a culture in which snow is a fundamental part of their existence, there's subtlety. So when you're trying to convey any kind of concept, failing to appreciate that you may be describing something that's just, my kids do that as, you're just not, there's no reason for you to, for that word to have meaning for you, even if you've got a way to translate it. Now we get to grazing, okay? Words in both languages. So there's a word for grazing in, I don't remember the name of the language in Uganda, and there's a word for grazing in English. Right? So no grazing when you're talking about sexual relationships. What do we think that means? Anybody, just jump right in.
Don't just have sex with any old person.
Don't sleep around, right? That, no grazing. One partner, right? When Bush put all his money into Uganda and declared it a great success story for ABC, abstinence, be faithful, use a condom. It's that be faithful thing. He was all over that. That's what zero grazing meant. All right? What zero grazing means in Uganda, I don't know if I can do this, but I'll try this. Okay. Over in this pasture, you have a bull. And the bull has five heifers, I don't know. All right? Over in this pasture, you have a female cow, and she has multiple partners. And these partnerships are long-standing. You don't let this bull go over here and have sex with anybody else. Right? So no grazing in Uganda didn't mean have one partner. It meant do not stray outside of well-established partnerships. So the idea of having multiple partners was not the issue. Because if you look at, try to do this up here. So this guy here has a wife and he has a mistress. But this mistress has a husband. And she has a long-standing relationship with her neighbor. In Uganda, zero grazing meant that's it, right? When this husband stops at a truck stop and has sex with a hooker who is HIV positive, he's not just infecting his wife, and disease spreads like wildfire through this entire web of relationships. So what they were really saying by zero grazing was stay within your own corral. Don't experiment outside that. And that was a concept that had meaning in Uganda. And the US interpretation of what happened was that all of a sudden people in Uganda were monogamous and faithful and used condoms and abstained and did, when in fact there was some other much more culturally normative process taking place. I don't think Bush believes that, but I think it's true. Another example of languages meaning is when words exist in both languages but have very different cultural values. All right? And we know that even as a mother with two teenagers, my concept of risk is very different than my teenagers. Right? Hopefully they've outgrown that, but nonetheless. When you talk about risks and benefits to communities, it very much depends on how individuals and that community view risk. All right? I had a Lebanese mother-in-law in an earlier part of my life who her concept of risk was very different than mine because she couldn't make decisions about risk because risk was something God did to you. Right? So bad things happened because God will them to happen. So for her to take action to control risk was not her problem, because that had been offered up to somebody else. When you're trying to say sexual risk behavior, it has a consequence in the future. Many cultures around the world have a very different attitude about one's ability to control or shape their future. Very much like my Lebanese mother-in-law. She didn't shape the future, somebody else did. Right? She did not associate her actions with a future event. That was considered, as it is in many cultures, in Africa in particular, it's considered presumptuous. It's considered almost guaranteeing you'll have a problem by contemplating risk. I was going to Jordan, and I took a Jewish journalist with me on a Jordanian airline right after the Achille Lauro. And there were people with guns on the plane, and I was sure we were going to be hijacked and it was going to be awful, but my mission was to escort this interviewer who was coming over to interview King Hussein. And we're on the plane together, and I'm already really jittery because I'm just not used to seeing people with Kalashnikovs sitting in the seat in front of me, but it's okay. I'm trying to put a good, brave face on the whole thing. And the plane hits unbelievable static. I don't mean static, but you know what I mean. And things are bouncing all over the place, and things are opening. And I'm over the Atlantic somewhere. I'm sure I'm going to be eaten by sharks. And the journalist is just going on and on. We're going to die. The wings are going to fall off. I bet if we weren't in first class, we'd live because we're going to crash first. But she's going on. I shouldn't have eaten that, you know, whatever. And I said, "What are you doing? You're scaring the bejesus out of me." And she says, "I'm Jewish. In my culture, if we talk about it, it doesn't happen." And I said, "Well, I'm Episcopalian. And if you talk about it, whoa, it's happening." So, you know, but that's a silly example. But you get my point, that different ways of conceptualizing even words that are the same will have an impact on how we think about them and how we think about them in the context of our own health.
We have about 45 minutes.
Okay. Validity. All right. The author of your article did talk about this. The validity between, she used it in the context of talking about how people report symptoms. Most rapid assessments don't have time for observation. All right. So most of the information you gather is reported, is self-reported, or it's reported about someone else. So there are a number of things that will shape how people report their behavior. One is something called social desirability, where they say what they think you want to hear, or they say what they think is the culturally or socially acceptable, socially desirable answer. You don't actually admit to eating the entire half gallon of ice cream because it's not socially acceptable. So when you're asked how much ice cream you eat, or aren't you often asked how many glasses of wine do you have a night? Does anybody ever actually say, "Oh, I have three"? No, it's not socially, you don't think it's socially desirable, so you say you report something else. You might alter your report of your own behaviors out of fear that there will be some reprisal for your answer. You may not report as a result of stigma or shame attached with the question. Does your husband beat you? You might well say no because you're embarrassed by it, right? A number of social phenomena, violence being one of them, are horribly underreported because people are afraid, they're ashamed, they see stigma attached to it. So if you're information about a community is entirely based on reported behavior, you may well be failing to actually capture what's going on. And you run this risk of underreporting, but you also run the risk of overreporting. Oh yeah, the women in this village, they all do X. You run the risk of having that. And you're going to draw conclusions about intervention design based on that information. So it's a sinkhole. It's often the best we have. Use of old of traditional anthropological methods would have been, I hope there's an anthropologist who has lived in this community for the last 25 years, whom I can consult. And one of the things that biomedical researchers often don't do that I find really surprising is I work with researchers from all over the United States who do work in Botswana, who some of whom have been there for years, who have never read a book of short stories about Botswana, have never visited a village, have never looked at the scholarly literature from anthropology on what life in Botswana is like and how it's changed, because that's not what they do. They have not brought this vast body of expertise to bear in how they shape it. They would prefer, and it is funded by NIH, to do a rapid assessment and kind of get a jump start on what they're going to do. The biggest, and I'm sure that Nora has talked about this and will continue to talk about this, is one of the things that often happens when you have cross-cultural research. You have a Western researcher or a researcher from somewhere going somewhere else, either to deliver clinical care or to conduct research, is that you may encounter people who have totally different explanatory models and belief systems about where disease comes from, what causes it, what cures it. And probably the best example is that everything that's not Western we call ethnomedicine. I don't know if you've talked about that yet, but this whole concept that real medicine is Western biomedical medicine and then everything else is ethnomedicine, failing to capture that in fact our Western medicine is in fact its own ethnomedicine. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's better or worse. It just means we need to respect the fact that a lot of our attitudes and decision-making in the biomedical realm are shaped by our own culture. And the same is true anywhere else in the world that you might go. So, as I said with the example of HIV/AIDS and SLIM versus the rights-based approach in Botswana, our Western values can actually shape how a disease is perceived in a community somewhere else in the world by how we present it. And lastly, and then we can take a quick break here, this whole issue of research in resource-constrained settings. And that I said it that way because resource-constrained does not have to be. It can be in our dooryard, as we all know. We design a lot of interventions, particularly when it comes to prevention of HIV, that are predicated on people exercising choice. And a lot of research in resource-constrained settings are conducted among populations and communities that do not even have basic needs. So choice is one of those words where they have a word for choice in Setswana, as they do in most languages around the world. But you're in a population where choice is a concept that is not, it's not part of their lived experience, right? So designing interventions that women have to negotiate, designing where people get to choose what they eat, that people are going to take, one of the biggest problems with antiretroviral therapy is it's how it interfaces with when people eat. It's one of the reasons in many parts of the world, in Botswana among them, people who are HIV positive and taking antiretroviral treatment are given food baskets because the medicine has to be taken on a full stomach. Hello. So you're in many parts of the world where a full stomach, they're not even sure what that means, ever. So the concept of interventions that are designed that don't think about things like food baskets, don't think about the fact that the 14-year-old is the HIV positive one and she or he gets the food basket, but no one else in the kinship group has any food, how much food do you think that 14-year-old gets? So these are really social kinds of things, but that have great implications for how we design interventions that require people exercising choice. Same is true with the exercise of autonomy. So if we expect someone to do something, That implies their ability to exercise autonomy. I will take my child to the clinic. I will not eat this kind of food. And many choices like that are not available to them. So another thing that happens that I find really interesting is that we often pride ourselves, and I think it's wonderful in terms of what we spend and do, what we do in global health, is we come up with third world interventions. You don't need a drug or a vaccine to cure this disease. You need to put this little white gauzy thing over your bottle of drinking water. Right? One of the things that happens in Botswana is people will travel into the capital city and they want an x-ray. They want a shot. They want a shot. They've gone to a Western doctor, and Western doctors use x-rays and give shots. So messages about prevention, or you know, you could just get water from another pump, Miss Cholera patient. Actually, you die pretty quickly from cholera, but you get the idea. So there's an interesting tension that goes in the reverse direction, that perceptions of what Western medicine means and what Western medicine delivers may in fact interfere with our ability to deliver certain kinds of interventions that are based on very simple strategies. And then lastly, research extenders. Now that's some big term that I'm still getting kind of used to living with. And it comes from relying on community members as informants. So we're going to identify people in the community and they will tell us all about what life is like here. And this use of community members to do your data collection, and you'll see that as I talk about my own research, where you bring people from the community to actually collect your data. And there are some pitfalls that occur that are kind of unique to that set of circumstances. Often, however, in biomedical research, what you find is that community engagement is superficial because its goal is something different. And the goal is often recruitment. You hear a lot in HIV research about preparing the community, which is just an unbelievable phrase, but you hear it all the time. We're going to prepare the community for a vaccine trial. So under the rubric of engagement, and discussion and input, what you're really doing is seeking buy-in. And that's going to shape how you collect, receive, and analyze your findings. Okay, so is this a good time for a quick break?
Sure.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and
I will
go through my own case study and its pitfalls. I have a lot of slides about what I did and what I found. I'm going to probably not tell you a lot about what I found in case you're really interested. But it's really how I did it and the problems I encountered and some of the solutions I came up with that I thought might be interesting.
And before I forget, if you like what you're hearing and you like this kind of stuff, Dr. Barchi and Dr. Merz are on the agenda for summer of 2012 for developing world research ethics.
Indeed, we are.
Yes. So
we have
mark
an alumna,
your calendars.
An alumna down there.
So do you want to stretch your legs real quick and get some more coffee?
About women in Malam. There are no clear demarcations of wards or neighborhoods in this community. There are no distinctions between what's a street and what's a path. There are no street names. There are no house numbers. There is no post office where there are addresses. And there are great ambiguities in what a household is. What we think a household is and what they think a household is not the same thing. Here's my own. So let me see, is my little light going to come on? Yes. See this cluster right here? Right here is kind of all inward facing around a dooryard, around a yard. It's called a yard there. You look over here, you see little houses next to big house, next to larger groupings. So you see, once you start delving into this, you see little clusters of houses. And then, of course, you see where the white safari people live up there in the corner. So here's a street. Here's a neighborhood. How many houses are in that picture? This is a street. This is actually going past one of the biggest elementary schools. I'm not sure, as I looked at it, that I actually thought that this was a street. So I wasn't quite sure what to make of this. This is a neighborhood. These little girls kind of adopted the study and were always a presence. This is just a little neighborhood, and here are these cinder block unfinished dwellings back here. And then we're back to this very traditional sort of compound looking thing here. So, my beloved doctoral chair said to me, here's how you do your sampling. You get a list of every address, and you use a random number sequencer to select from that. And you're going to stratify and randomly select your neighborhoods. And I literally brought her, I went to Mound, I took pictures, I came back and said, let's go over this one more time. How do you want me to do this? And I eventually came up with using an Africa-specific sampling technique, which is created by something called Afrobarometer, that does public opinion polling in 20 countries in Africa, who have the same problem. They're polling nomadic populations. They're polling people that live in refugee camps. How do you do this? So first we sampled by ward, and wards, remember, are not clearly demarcated. And then we sampled by household within the ward. And then we sampled according to eligible women within each household. So, this is day one. Off go our ladies. And the way we started our day was, I put the eight ladies in a room and said, okay, where is the Bosasia ward? There were no maps. There were no guidelines. They thought an old petrol station had a map on its wall. So that was where we started our day, was let's see if we can figure out where the different demarks of the ward. So now I was totally dependent on local knowledge. My eight ladies back and forth, where the ends of the wards were. And by the same token, I relied on them to tell me where the center of each ward was. Day would start, we'd drive to the center of the ward. They were assigned random numbers. So if you happen to be, and I did this back in the States, so I didn't realize what I was doing. If you happen to be the poor woman that came up on the random number generator as number 8, you started at the center and you walked to the 8th house. That was the first house where you interviewed, and then you went to every other house after that. Well, 8 houses could be several miles. So off they went. But 8 days later, I had 469 completed interviews, and each interview contained 208 variables with subsets below that. I had 38,000 data points, which is a whole other problem, by the way. Never collect too much data. And I haven't got time to do this, but we found various things out as a result of looking at this data. And we had a series of hypotheses where I had assumed, based on my reading of the literature, that women who had very limited autonomy were more likely to feel bad, be depressed, and have thought about killing themselves. That seemed very reasonable. What I found instead was that my autonomy measures that I used, these international standards, did not tell me anything. Nothing. With one exception, women who had more money reported they were in better health. And it absolutely didn't matter whether or not they were, in fact, in better health. So economic independence, if they had more control over resources, they seemed to do better. And they perceived themselves to be doing better, even when all other data might have pointed to the contrary. So resources were positively associated. The more resources, the more likely they were to tell you they were in good health. I also theorized, based on the literature, that women who had experienced intimate partner violence were more likely to say they were in poor health, meet the criteria for depression, and have contemplated suicide. Sad reality of social science life is that you get really excited when those hypotheses are true. So you find yourself getting really excited that you found an effect. And indeed, intimate partner violence is strongly associated with self-reported health, all right? But that's only when you look at violence and whether women say they're healthy. When you start throwing other social criteria into the mix, it is no longer predictive. If a woman's experienced violence, she had double the odds of meeting the criteria for depression, and she had triple the odds that she would have at some point in her life contemplated suicide. So, if you're treating depression in women, one of the possible messages from this finding is you better ask her about violence. Women with limited autonomy, I hypothesized, would be more likely to report intimate partner violence. The autonomy measures told me nothing about violence. All right? Freedom of movement, economic independence, control of resources, and role in decision making. I tried very hard to undo these hypotheses in the course of my study and instead had to just accept the fact that my hypotheses were garbage. All right, I'm going to keep going here. And we can always come back to that. So, part of my problem, one of my reasons my autonomy measures didn't work very well, is they were measuring concepts that were foreign in this population. I'll give you two examples. Role in decision making. Remember I told you that Botswana was a consensus-driven culture? Everybody consults with everybody. They don't necessarily make the decision, but very few people accept the head of a kinship group or the chief of a tribal cluster. Very few people will tell you they make the decisions. They consult. Meetings take forever in Botswana because everyone in the room has a say. And frequently what happens traditionally is then the leader of that group makes a decision. It doesn't have to even reflect the input of the group, but everybody has a say. And nothing moves forward until that process has taken place. So my women in this study participate in decision making all the time. So all their answers were yes. They scored really high on all these scales that measured their participation in decision making. Is that actually what I meant? At the end of the day, did they get to decide what happened? No. Another thing I found was that, yes, they had a lot of control over what you were going to cook for dinner. It's like saying, I have a lot of control over whether or not I do the laundry. But the laundry is my job. So I learn a lot less about my autonomy by asking questions that are not appropriate to the culture. In India, in many households where there is usually a mother-in-law, because the bride goes to her parents' home, she does not participate in decision-making about what to serve. She has to ask permission to go to the market. Not so in Botswana. So the concept of autonomy that I thought I was going to capture using these internationally accepted tools didn't work. I was missing something. What I think I was missing was something called self-efficacy. The ability to say, I want this outcome, and here's what I have to do to get it. Women frequently, that's what I fail to capture, this ability, sort of coping mechanism. I ask no questions about it, so my concept of autonomy may not have been flawed, but I used an inappropriate set of measures to understand the phenomenon. And that's one of the problems with qualitative research, is you've got to have good tools when you're doing it. Households. Okay, remember the picture of this traditional compound that had four houses in it? You're the little data collector. How many households are there? There's a fence around it. One or four? Those are really your only choices. I didn't know the answer to that. And I actually went back twice and did focus groups because I literally didn't know the answers. And if I didn't figure out the answers, I had bad data. And I was going to have to throw it out, and never throw out data. You fight very hard to have your data be good. Answer, who would have thought of this? Cook fires. What does that mean? The four houses? How many cook fires? There's one cook fire, it's one household. If there are four cook fires, it's four households. Now, my local data collectors never got it wrong. I literally put them in a combi you know, one of those ubiquitous white vans they put 20 people in that have a limit of 8, you know, those things. Ask them, and we drive, they got it right every single time. It was just local knowledge. If I had had UPenn set Swanee-speaking research assistants and sent them out in the field, they would have missed it. I would have missed it. If I had been driving this process, I would have been sitting there saying, wait, there are 2 more houses in this compound, and you're doing every other one. You can't stop. They understood that almost intuitively. I had a lot of data where I'd say, I wanted to know how many children she had, and she'd say she'd be 24 years old, and she would have 4 children. So how old can those children be, realistically, right? They're all probably 10 or younger, right? Flip through the questionnaire, get to a page that says, how many children under the age of 15 live in your house? Answer, 0. Ooh, we have a problem. Couple more pages. How many children, who makes the decision in your household about where children go to school? Answer, I do. I'm in Maine, flipping through data. I am now sick to my stomach. I have bad data. Back to Botswana, sit with my local data crew and say, can you explain what's going on here? What's going on here is that there is kinship fosterage all over Botswana. Remember, many women don't marry. So I'm 24. I'm not married. I may have had 4 or more. If I have 4 children, I may have had 4 primary mates. I need to work. What do? I send my children to my mother, who's just possibly on the other side of the yard, possibly in another village. A lot of people come to Habaroni, the capital city, for education and employment. Their children are raised in the home village. Do they make decisions about where their children go to school and when they go to school? Yes, they are the principal decision maker. I, as the Western researcher, am looking at this data going, this is horrible. How did this happen? Oh my gosh, I'm done. I'm toast. I'm going to be 90 before I get this degree. Part of the problem was local women, it never occurred to them that this had to be explained. They never even saw the obvious data disconnect, right? If you'd been collecting that data here, there would have been a little thing that said, if no, skip to question 42. And we would have gone all the way past those questions about decision-making vis-a-vis children. And we would have been wrong. So I was able to make a case to my committee that my data was good, that I didn't have to throw it out, but I had to analyze it differently. And I had to spend a lot of time explaining it. And I had to explain it not with quantitative information, but with qualitative information. Head of households. If you ask a housemaid in Habaroni who lives in a small house behind your flat, who is the head? She's there by herself. And you ask her who's the head of her household, and you mean in this household where you're sleeping, she's going to tell you her mother is. And her mother could be on the other side of the country, right? So head of household is titular as well as a respected concept that has nothing to do with place, all right? So the head of my household at 58, married with children and a dog in Philadelphia, the answer could have been my 94-year-old mother in Florida. And you can't challenge that answer. You can't tell anybody that that's not right. And you can't talk your way around it, because conceptually, it is the head of their household. It's not that they misunderstood my question. The first time I was in Botswana, I said to the Penn flats have housekeepers that take care of the house and kind of keep us all in line. And they're local women who are given jobs. But they always appeared very early in the morning. So the housekeeper that took care of us in my house, I said, well, where do you live? She said, I live in Mokolodi. And I said, well, how far away is that? She said, it's 6 hours by bus, by combi. I said, well, no, wait a minute. Where do you live? She said, well, I live in Mokolodi. So finally I said, where do you sleep at night? Sit over there. So how you phrase questions, and how she meant where she was from is where she lived. And I could not disabuse her of that and impose this very Western, where you live is where you sleep at night, but not in this in some settings, and certainly not here. So you couldn't take at face value what that answer was. Do you work for wages? By asking that as a question of finding out whether or not women earned money, what do you think I left out if that was the only question I asked? A, I left out all informal earnings. The women who sold candy. The women who worked in the relief programs. When the river comes down, everything floods and there's mud everywhere. And the people in Botswana take great pride. They have no grass. They don't use outdoor tile and turf. They're dirt yards, and there's a great pride in everything being cleanly swept and their beautiful designs. And so one of the employment projects is hiring women to keep the streets clean when it floods, and they earn money. I don't capture that. The other thing, that the presumption in that phrase, do you work for wages, which then codes to employed or unemployed, is you are assuming that every transaction is a money-based transaction. That there's no barter, that there's no change for food, you're missing vast resources. And for the most of the women that I interviewed for this study, most of them, 82% of them, were unemployed. The answer to that question was no. But 58% of them were unmarried and had children. So you wonder how they ate. And so there was this whole other support microcosm going on that I absolutely missed. Right? And I missed it by asking what in my world seemed like a really straightforward question. I thought I was going to know a lot from that answer. And the fact is I do know there's high unemployment, and that might be good if I'm talking to the World Bank, but it didn't actually help me because my question was, are you without resources? It's a very different question. Forced. Here's another one. In my violence study, at the first time you had sex, did you do it because you were curious, thought it was all your friends were doing it, or were you forced? There's a word in Setswana for forced, and my head of African languages at the University of Botswana put the Setswana word in there, and the answers were often yes. Flip a couple more pages. Has anyone in your life ever forced you to have sex against your will?
No.
No. Back to Botswana. Forced, it was the right translation, and back-to-back translation and back translation would not have caught it and didn't catch it, means pressured. When you contextualize the question by against your will, it meant rape. So I had this disconnect. I actually didn't use the data. I couldn't justify that all women thought forced meant pressured, and all women thought that forced against their will to have sex meant rape. So it's dead data. It's no good to me. I don't think everybody would have made that conclusion, but that was definitely a conclusion I made. And lastly, the biggie, relationship status. Okay? All over the world, every population census in the world has these categories. Single, married, living in union, divorced and separated, and widowed. You have five choices. And everybody gets crammed into those little choices. In Botswana, relationships operate along a continuum. And the continuum is marked by various social norms and ceremonies that alter your status. But running in parallel is you go to the district commissioner and you get married, It doesn't work out, you get separated for a trial period of time. It doesn't work out, you get divorced. The guy dies, you're widowed. I mean, so in parallel are the single, married, living in union, divorced, separated, and widowed. All right? In Maon, and I cannot generalize this even to all of Botswana. In Maon, there is a point in the traditional ceremony, which is now very modern, by the way, where the groom's family visits the bride's family, and the groom gives gifts to the woman. It's called patlo. When that happens, the status of the woman changes in that the families are sanctioning a union. That, if you ask a woman for whom there has been patlo, her status, she's going to tell you she's married. She may never get married, ever. But the kinship groups have sanctioned the union. All right? So, you have people who have lived in the same house with men to whom they are not married for years and years, who will never be married because the families will not recognize the union. These social norms have not, these social customs have not taken place, right? If you go get a civil ceremony and get married and you have not had a bride price paid, which is used to be in cattle, and now is, they call it pocket cattle, which is cash, so a woman can still be, the bride price could still be 8 cows, but it often translates into cash or provisions or money. And that's a family transaction. If you have been married through the payment of that bride price, regardless of whether or not you were ever actually married in a court, you are protected as if you were married under traditional law. You have rights as a woman and as a man, but particularly as a woman. You have no rights under the civil court, the Roman Dutch court law. If you were, by contrast, married in a civil ceremony, but did not have these other things happen, as far as your kinship group is concerned, you're not married. So I have friends that were educated in the U.S., gone home, have gotten married, they have children, they are not married. And while they have legal rights in court, in the Roman Dutch law, they have no rights in the traditional law. So it is a much more complex construct than my Western little mind ever imagined. And so again, what came back to me was bad data. Back for a focus group, talking to the ladies that collected the data, they didn't understand what the problem was. They could not imagine why this didn't make any sense to me. And it was only when you spent time getting qualitative information and listening did any of this make any sense. And I can do it now. Living in union, by the way, is not spatially bound. It's not a spatial concept. You are living in union with a man who is your primary mate. You may not be married to them, you may be married to them, but your entire lives, they may even live in a different community. But because they are part of your relationship structure, a woman under those set circumstances would say, yes, I live in union. In the U.S., would that count as living in union? No. Right? It's because it's spatial. It's a spatially bound concept.
I think we may actually have to end there. Oof.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
But I have a summary, but I give you a chance to sort of say what,
okay,
if you want to sort of take home
messages.
Mm-hmm.
We bring a lens that we never shed when we go into other cultures, and we need to be very mindful of it. Even our tools reflect that lens and how we think about that lens. So not only do we need to show some sensitivity to the communities in which we're doing research, we have to be cautious in how we even seek to understand those communities. The biomedical paradigm, which is looking at a disease model and therefore developing strategies to intervene in the either the onset of a disease or the disease progression. Failing to take into account that there are cultural forces that will shape how members of a community will think about disease, respond to disease, and do something about disease is absolutely critical that you need that qualitative piece. And I think if we don't do it well, it's quick, it's practical, and it's wrong. I guess that, and so that's where I would end.
Thank you so much.
Oh, here are my girls. There they are.